papers. Write her a pardon. Put these people under a debt of gratitude to you, if you want them to leave off their foolish sentiment towards Catherine. You think you can buy hearts? Charles Brandon says. He sounds as if he would be sad if the answer were yes. He thinks the heart is like any other organ. You can weigh it on a scale. It is not a price in money we are offering. I have enough to put the Courtney family on trial, all Exeter's people. If we forbear to do it, we are offering their freedom and their lands. We are giving them a chance to recoup the honour of their name. Henry says, his grandfather left Crookbank for my father's service. If we forgive them, they will play us for fools, Charles says. I think not, my lord. Everything they do from now on, they do under my eye. And the Poles, Lord Montague, what do you propose there? He should not assume he will be pardoned. Make him sweat, eh? Charles says. I'm not sure I like your way of dealing with noblemen. They get their deserts, the king says. Hush, my lord, I need to think. A pause. Brandon's position is too complicated for him to sustain. He wants to say, pay them out as traitors, Cromwell. But mind you butcher them respectfully. Suddenly his face clears. Ah, now I remember Greenwich. The snow was knee-deep that year. Ah, we were young then, Harry. You don't get snow any more, like you did when we were young. He gathers up his papers and begs to be excused. Reminiscence is setting in for the afternoon, and there is work to be done. Rafe, ride over to West Horsley. Tell Exeter's wife the king thinks all women fickle and weak, though I should have thought he has plenty of evidence to the contrary. Tell her to set down in writing that she has not the wit of a flea. Tell her to claim she is exceptionally easy to mislead, even for a woman. Tell her to grovel. Advise her on the wording. You know how to do it. Nothing can be too humble for Henry. This is the season for humility. The word from the talks in Marseille is that King Francis has fallen at the Pope's feet and kissed his slippers. When the news comes, Henry bellows in obscenity and shreds the dispatch in his hands. He collects up the pieces, lays it out on a table, and reads it. Francis has kept faith with you after all, he says, surprisingly. He has persuaded the Pope to suspend his bull of excommunication. England has a breathing space. I wish Pope Clement in his grave, Henry says. God knows he's a man of filthy life, and he's always ailing, so he ought to die. Sometimes, he says, I pray that Catherine might be translated into glory. Is that wrong? If you snap your fingers, Majesty, 100 priests will come running to tell you right from wrong. It seems I prefer to hear it from you. Henry broods in a sulky, twitching silence. If Clement dies, who will be the next rogue in office? I put my money on Alessandro Farnese. Really? Henry sits up. One lays bets. But the odds are short. He has thrown about such bribes to the Roman mob all these years that they will put the cardinals in terror when the time comes. Remind me, how many children has he? 4 I know of. The king is looking into the tapestry on the near wall, where white-shouldered women walk barefoot on a carpet of spring flowers. I may have another child soon. The queen has spoken to you? Not yet. But he sees, we all do, the flare of colour in Anne's cheeks, the silk sleekness of her person, the tone of command ringing in her voice as she hands out favours and rewards the people around her. This last week, there are more rewards than black looks, and Stephen Vaughan's wife, who is in the bedchamber, says she has missed her courses. The king says, she has missed her... And then he stops, blushing like a schoolboy. He crosses the room, flings open his arms and embraces him, shining like a star, his great hands with their blazing rings seizing handfuls of the black velvet of his jacket. This time for sure! England is ours! Archaic, that cry from his heart. As if he were standing on the battlefield between the blooded banners, the crown in a thorn bush, his enemies dead at his feet. He disengages himself gently, smiling. He uncrumples the memorandum he had clenched in his fist when the king seized him. Because is that not how men embrace? They knead each other with big fists, as if to knock each other down. Henry squeezes his arm and says, "Thomas, it's like hugging a seawall. What are you made of?" He takes the paper. He gulps. "Is this what we must do this morning, this list?" "Not more than 50 items we shall soon work through." For the rest of the day he cannot stop smiling. Who cares for Clement and his bulls? He might as well stand on cheap and let the populace pelt him. He might as well stand under the Christmas garlands, which we dust with flour in years when there is no snow, and sing, "Hey, nonny, no, fa-la-la, under the trees so green-o." On a cold day towards the end of November, the maid and half a dozen of her principal supporters do penance at Paul's Cross. They stand shackled and barefoot in a whipping wind. The crowd is large and boisterous, the sermon lively, telling what the maid did on her night walks when her sisters in religion were sleeping, and what lurid tales of devils she told to keep her followers in awe. Her confession is read out, at the end of which she asks the Londoners to pray for her, and begs for the king's mercy. You wouldn't know her now for the bonny girl they had at Lambeth. She looks haggard and 10 years older. Not that she has been hurt. He would not countenance that for a woman. And in fact, they have all talked without duress. The hard thing has been to stop them complicating the story by rumours and fantasies, so that half England is dragged into it. The one priest who had persistently lied, he had simply locked up with an informer. The man was detained for murder, and in no time at all Father Rich had set about saving his soul and interpreting to him the maid's prophecies and impressing him with the names of important people he knew at court. Pitiful, really. But it has been necessary to put on this show, and next he will take it to Canterbury, so Dame Elizabeth can confess on her home ground. It is necessary to break the hold of these people who talk of the end times and threaten us with plagues and damnation. It is necessary to dispel the terror they create. Thomas More is there, jostled among the city dignitaries. He's making towards him now, as the preachers step down and the prisoners have been led from the platform. More rubs his cold hands. He blows on them. "Her crime is, she was made use of." He thinks, "Why did Alice let you out without your gloves?" "For all the testimony I've got," he says, "I still cannot understand how she arrived here from the edge of the marshes to a public scaffold at Paul's. For sure, she made no money out of it." "How will you frame the charges?" His tone is neutral, interested, lawyer to lawyer. "The common law does not deal with women who say they can fly or raise the dead. I shall put an act of attainder into Parliament. Treason charges for the principals. The accessories, life imprisonment, confiscation, fines. The king will be circumspect, I think. Even merciful. I'm more interested in unravelling the plans of these people than exacting penalties. I don't want to try with scores of defendants and hundreds of witnesses, tying the courts up for years." Moore hesitates. "Come on," he says. "You would have seen them off that way yourself when you were Chancellor." "You may be right. I am clear anyway." A pause. Moore says, "Thomas, in the name of Christ, you know that." "As long as the king knows it. We must keep it firmly in his mind. A letter from you, perhaps, inquiring after the Princess Elizabeth. I can do that. Making it plain you accept her rights and title. That is not a difficulty. The new marriage is made and must be accepted. You don't think you could bring yourself to praise it?" "Why does the king want other men to praise his wife?" "Suppose you were to write an open letter, to say that you have seen the light in the matter of the king's natural jurisdiction over the church, He looks across to where the prisoners are being loaded into the waiting carts. They're taking them back to the tower now. He pauses. You mustn't stand about. Come home with me to dinner. No. Moore shakes his head. I would rather be blown around on the river and go home hungry. If I could trust you only to put food in my mouth, but you will put words into it. He watches him melt into the crowd of home-going aldermen. He thinks, Moore is too proud to retreat from his position. He's afraid to lose his credibility with the scholars in Europe. We must find some way for him to do it that doesn't depend on abjection. The sky has cleared now to a flawless lapis blue. The London gardens are bright with berries. There is an obdurate winter ahead, but he feels a force ready to break. A spring breaks from the dead tree. As the word of God spreads, the people's eyes are open to new truths. Until now, like Helen Barr, they knew Noah and the flood, but not St. Paul. They could count over the sorrows of our Blessed Mother, and say how the damned are carried down to hell. But they did not know the manifold miracles and sayings of Christ, nor the words and deeds of the apostles, simple men who, like the poor of London, pursued simple wordless trades. The story is much bigger than they ever thought it was. He says to his nephew Richard, You cannot tell people just part of the tale and then stop, or just tell them the parts you choose. They have seen their religion painted on the walls of churches or carved in stone. But now God's pen is poised, and he is ready to write his words in the books of their hearts. But in these same streets, Chapuis sees the stirrings of sedition, a city ready to open its gates to the emperor. He was not at the sack of Rome, but there are nights when he dreams of it, as if he had been there, the black guts spilled on antique pavements, the half-dead draped in the fountains, the chiming of bells through the marsh fog, the flames of arsonists' torches leaping along the walls. Rome has fallen, and everything within it. It was not invaders, but Pope Julius himself, who knocked down old St. Peter's, which had stood for 1,200 years, the site where the Emperor Constantine himself had dug the first trench. 12 scoops of soil, one for each of the apostles, where the Christian martyrs, sown into the skins of wild beasts, had been torn apart by dogs. 25 feet he dug down to lay his new foundations, through a necropolis, through 12 centuries of fish bones and ash, his workmen's shovels powdering the skulls of saints. In the place where martyrs had bled, ghost white boulders stood, marble, waiting for Michelangelo. In the street, he sees a priest carrying the host, no doubt to a dying Londoner. The passers-by uncover their heads and kneel, but a boy leans out of an upper window and jeers, "Show us your Christ is risen! Show us your jack-in-the-box!" He glances up. The boy's face, before it vanishes, is vivid with rage. He says to Cranmer, "These people want a good authority, one they can properly obey. For centuries Rome has asked them to believe what only children could believe. Surely they will find it more natural to obey an English king, who will exercise his powers under Parliament and under God." 2 days after he sees Moore, shivering at the sermon, he conveys a pardon to Lady Exeter. It comes with some blistering words from the king, directed to her husband. It is St. Catherine's Day, in honour of the saint who was threatened with martyrdom on a wheel. We all walk in circles to our destination. At least, that's the theory. He has never seen anyone over the age of 12 actually doing it. There's a feeling of power in reserve, a power that drives right through the bone, like the shiver you sense in the shaft of an axe when you take it into your hand. You can strike, or you cannot strike, and if you choose to hold back the blow, you can still feel inside you the resonance of the omitted thing. Next day at Hampton Court, the king's son, the Duke of Richmond, marries Norfolk's daughter, Mary. Anne has arranged this marriage for the glorification of the Howards. Also, to stop Henry marrying his bastard to the boy's advantage, to some princess abroad. She has persuaded the king to waive the magnificent dower payment he would have expected, and triumphant in all her designs, she joins the dancing, her thin face flushed, her shining hair braided with dagger tips of diamonds. Henry cannot take his eyes off her, and nor can he. Richmond draws to him all other eyes, gambling like a colt, showing off his wedding finery, turning, leaping, bouncing and strutting. "Look at him," the older ladies say, "and you will see how his father was once, that perfect glow, skin as thin as a girl's." "Master Cromwell," he demands, "tell the king, my father, that I want to live with my wife. He says that I am to go back to my household, and Mary is to stay with the queen."
"He has a care for your health, my lord."
"I am 15 next."
"It wants half a year till your birthday."
The boy's blithe expression vanishes. A stony look takes over his face. "Half a year is nothing. A man of 15 is competent."
"So we hear," Lady Rochford says, standing idly by. "The king, your father, brought witnesses to court to say his brother could do the deed at 15, and more than once a night."
"It is also your bride's health that we need to think of."
"Brandon's wife is younger than mine, and he has her."
"Every time he sees her," Lady Rochford says, if I judge by the startled expression on her face.
Richmond is digging himself in for a long argument, entrenching himself behind precedent. It is his father's way of arguing. "Did not my great-grandmother, Lady Margaret Beaufort, give birth at 13 years to the prince who will be Henry Tudor?"
"Bosworth, the tattered standards, the bloody field, the stained sheet of maternity. Where do we all come from," he thinks, "but this same hole and corner dealing? Sweetheart, yield to me. I never heard it improve her health," he says, "or her temper. She had no children after." Suddenly he is tired of the argument. He cuts it short, his voice tired and flat. "Be reasonable, my lord. Once you've done it, you want to do it all the time, for about 3 years. That's the way it goes. And your father hath other work in mind for you. He may send you to hold court in Dublin."
Jane Rochford says, "Be easy, my lamb. There are ways that can be contrived. A man may always meet a woman, if she is willing."
"May I speak as your friend, Lady Rochford? You risk the king's displeasure if you meddle in this."
"Oh," she says easily. "Henry will forgive anything to a pretty woman. They only seek to do what is natural." The boy says,
"Why should I live like a monk?"
"A monk? They go to it like goats. Master Cromwell here will tell you."
"Perhaps," Richmond says, "it is Madame the Queen who wants to keep us apart. She doesn't mean the king to have a grandson in the cradle before he has a son of his own."
"But do you not know?" Jane Rochford turns to him. "Has it not reached your ears that La Anna is enceinte?"
She gives her the name Chapuis gives her. He sees the boy's face open in blank dismay. Jane says, "I fear by summer you will have lost your place, sweetheart. Once he has a son born in wedlock, you may tup to your heart's content. You will never reign, and your offspring will never inherit." It isn't often that you see a princeling's hopes destroyed, in the instant it takes to pinch out a candle flame, and with the same calculated movement, as if born of the neatness of habit. She has not even licked her fingers. Richmond says, his face crumpling, "It may be another girl."
"It is almost treason to hope so," Lady Rochford says. "And if it is, she will have a third child and a fourth. I thought she would not conceive again, but I was wrong, Master Cromwell. She has proved herself now."
Cranmer is in Canterbury, walking on a path of sand barefoot to his enthronement as Primate of England. The ceremony done, he's sweeping out the Priory of Christchurch, whose members gave so much encouragement to the false prophetess. It could be a long job, interviewing each monk, picking their stories apart.
Roland Lee storms into town to put some brawn into the business, and Gregory is in his train. So he sits in London reading a letter from his son, no longer nor more informative than his schoolboy letters. And now no more for lack of time. He writes to Cranmer, be merciful to the community there, as nothing worse than misled. Spare the monk who gilded the Magdalene's letter. I suggest they give a present in cash to the king. £300 will please him. Clean out Christchurch and the whole diocese. Warham was archbishop for 30 years. His family are entrenched. His bastard son is archdeacon. Take a new broom to them. Put in people from home, your sad East Midlands clerks, formed under sober skies. There is something beneath his desk, under his foot, the nature of which he has avoided thinking about. He pushes his chair back. It is half a shrew, a gift from Marlinspike. He picks it up and thinks of Henry Wyatt, eating vermin in his cell. He thinks of the Cardinal, resplendent at Cardinal College. He throws the shrew on the fire. The corpse fizzes and shrivels, bones gone with an empty little pop. He picks up his pen and writes to Cranmer, shake out those Oxford men from your diocese, and put in Cambridge men we know. He writes to his son, come home, and spend the new year with us. December. In her frozen angularity, a blue light behind her cast up from the snow, Margaret Pole looks as if she has stepped from a church window, slivers of glass shaking from her gown. In fact, those splinters are diamonds. He has made her come to him, the Countess, and now she looks at him from beneath her heavy lids. She looks at him down her long Plantagenet nose, and her greeting, ice-bright, flies out into the room. Cromwell! Just that. She comes to business.
The Princess Mary? Why must she quit the house in Essex?
My Lord Rochford wants it for his use. It's good hunting country, you see. Mary is to join her royal sister's household at Hatfield. She will not need her own attendance there.
I offer to support my place in her household at my own expense. You cannot prevent me from serving her.
Try me. I am only the minister of the king's wishes, and you, I suppose, are as anxious as I am to carry them out.
These are the wishes of the concubine. We do not believe, the princess and I, that they are the king's own wishes.
You must stretch your credulity, madam. She looks down at him from her plinth. She is Clarence's daughter, old King Edward's niece. In her time, men like him knelt down to speak to women like her.
I was in Catherine the Queen's suite on the day she was married. To the princess, I stand as a second mother.
Blood of Christ, madam. You think she needs a second? The one she has will kill her. They stare at each other across an abyss. Lady Margaret, if I may advise you, your family's loyalty is suspect.
So you say. This is why you are parting me from Mary, as punishment. If you have matter enough to indict me, then send me to the Tower with Elizabeth Barton.
That would be much against the king's wishes. He reveres you, madam, your ancestry, your great age.
He has no evidence.
In June last year, just after the queen was crowned, your son, Lord Montague, and your son, Geoffrey Pole, dined with Lady Mary. Then a scant 2 weeks later, Montague dined with her again. I wonder what they discussed.
Do you really?
No, he says, smiling. The boy who carried in the dish of asparagus, that was my boy. The boy who sliced the apricots was mine, too. They talked about the Emperor, about the invasion, how he might be brought to it. So you see, Lady Margaret, all your family owes much to my forbearance. I trust they will repay the king with future loyalty. He does not say, I mean to use your sons against their troublemaking brother abroad. He does not say, I have your son Geoffrey on my payroll. Geoffrey Pole is a violent, unstable man. You do not know how he will turn. He has paid him £40 this year to turn the Cromwell way. The Countess curls her lip.
The Princess will not leave her home quietly.
My Lord of Norfolk intends to write to Bewley, to tell her of the change in her circumstances. She may defy him, of course. He had advised the King, leave Mary in possession of her style as Princess, do not diminish anything. Do not give her cousin, the Emperor, a reason to make war. Henry had shouted, Will you go to the Queen and suggest to her that Mary keep her title? For I tell you, Master Cromwell, I'm not going to do it. And if you put her in a great passion, as you will, and she falls ill and miscarries her child, you will be responsible, and I shall not incline to mercy. Outside the door of the presence chamber, he leans on the wall. He rolls his eyes and says to Rafe, God in heaven, no wonder the Cardinal was old before his time. If he thinks her peak will dislodge it, he cannot be stuck very fast. Last week I was his brother in arms. This week he is threatening me with a bloody end. Rafe says, It is a good thing you're not like the Cardinal. Indeed. The Cardinal expected the gratitude of his prince, in which matter he was bound to be disappointed. For all his capacities, he was a man whose emotions would master him and wear him out. He, Cromwell, is no longer subject to vagaries of temperament, and he's almost never tired. Obstacles will be removed, tempers will be soothed, knots unknotted. Here, at the close of the year 1533, his spirit is sturdy, his will strong, his front imperturbable. The courtiers see that he can shape events, mould them. He can contain the fears of other men and give them a sense of solidity in a quaking world. This people, this dynasty, this miserable rainy island at the edge of the world. By way of recreation at the end of the day, he is looking into Catherine's land holdings and judging what he can redistribute. Sir Nicholas Carew, who does not like him and does not like Anne, is amazed to receive from him a package of grants, including 2 fat Surrey manors, to adjoin his existing holdings in the county. He seeks an interview to express his thanks. He has to ask Richard, who keeps the Cromwell diary now, and Richard fits him in after 2 days. As the Cardinal used to say, deference means making people wait. When Carew comes in, he is arranging his face. Chilly, self-absorbed, the complete courtier, he works at turning up the corners of his mouth. The result is a maidenly simper, incongruous above a luxuriant beard. "Oh, I am sure you are deserving," he says, shrugging it off. "You are a boyhood friend of His Majesty, and nothing gives him greater pleasure than to reward his old friends. Your wife is in touch with the Lady Mary, is she not? They are close. Ask her," he says gently, "to give the young woman good advice. Warn her to be conformable to the King in all things. His temper is short these days, and I cannot answer for the consequences of defiance. Deuteronomy tells us, gifts blind the eyes of the wise. Carew is not particularly wise, in his opinion, but the principle holds good, and if not exactly blinded, at least he looks dazed. Call it an early Christmas present," he tells him, smiling. He pushes the papers across his desk. At Austin Friars, they are cleaning out storerooms and building strongrooms. They will keep the feast at Stepney. The angel's wings are moved there. He wants to keep them, till there is another child in the house of the right size. He sees them going, shivering in their shroud of fine linen, and watches the Christmas star loaded onto a cart. Christoph asks,
How would one work it, that savage machine that is all over points?
He draws off one of the canvas sleeves, shows him the gilding.
Jesus Maria, the boy says. The star that guides us to Bethlehem, I thought it was an engine for torture.
Norfolk goes down to Bewley to tell Lady Mary she must move to the manor at Hatfield, and be an attendant to the little princess, and live under the governance of Lady Anne Shelton, aunt to the Queen. What ensues, he reports back in aggrieved tones.